Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our weekly conversations include you, and the phone lines are open if you'd like to join us from Oahu. The number is 941-3689. That's 941-3689. And if you call us from the neighbor islands or anywhere else you may be listening to the live stream, the number to reach us is 877, then the 941-3689. Last month, we had another couple of reminders that we are far from being color and race blind. The much-publicized remarks of Representative Faye Hanohano, later her reprimand by House Speaker Suki, plus the racial rant of a Maui man, gave us the opportunity to again look at ourselves, and hopefully not with smoke and mirrors, just mirrors. We thought it was time for another one of our frank Town Square conversations about racism in Hawaii, what it is and whether it's different here and what that looks like. This time we've invited Mita Chesney-Lind, professor and chair of the UH Women's Studies Department. She's internationally known for her work on girls, women, and the law, particularly her work on the issues of women in the criminal justice system. Jonathan Osorio is also here. He is professor in the UH School of Hawaiian Knowledge. He writes and teaches about Hawaii's politics, history, music, identity, and indigenous civil rights and social justice. And again, you're here too, 941-3689, if you'd like to pull up to our table, or 877-941-3689. Thank you both for being here.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
John, I want to start with you. This is a tough conversation for a lot of people to have because it means we have to look at ourselves and ask ourselves some questions that maybe probably are really uncomfortable. But none of this can be looked at without taking a very long look into history and to see how the issue of racism has been set up in Hawaii for hundreds of years.
Well, yeah, certainly over 150 years. I mean, the way we look at race in Hawaii is actually a composite of many things, and one of them is naturally the fact that there was a group of people here, Kanaka Maoli, who over the course of time have seen many, many people come to the shores and have actually basically worked with each arriving group, you know, as colleagues in the field, so to speak, but also as competitors for resources. I mean, it's a very complex kind of relationship. But you also have, especially over the last 100 years, a very careful manipulation of race by powerful institutions in Hawaii, in particular the plantation owners and plantation managers, the territorial governments, even the kingdom government sort of oversaw this kind of positioning of people being really basically exploited, Chinese, Japanese, Filipino laborers, trying to keep the cost of labor down, plantation owners who were really, really concerned that these people might unionize together and cooperate together and create unions and collectively bargain for higher wages. For all of these reasons, the business community, the large landowners took an active hand in trying to keep the races keep these groups of people separate and sort of at each other's throats. So much information that we have about the ways in which Kanaka Maoli, Hawaiian political opinion and political alliances were manipulated by the Republicans in the early 1900s. And then overseeing all of this, and this is one of the things that I think is really, really important, this overwhelming kind of presentation by plantation owners, merchants, public officials, literature people, academics, this notion that people of color really had no business governing themselves.
And couldn't.
Yes, they couldn't. They couldn't manage it. That Hawaii really was proceeding along a progressive path, but it was only progressive because white people were in charge, and this kind of discourse wasn't subtle. It was really quite open. They had a eugenics for young people curriculum that was introduced at the Kamehameha schools. Mm. Both Noelani Goodyear Kaʻopua and Ilima Long have written about this and what they describe is an out and out and very blatant attempt to convince young Hawaiians that they were degenerates, that they were genealogically unfit really to survive.
And totally inferior.
And totally inferior. And that their only hope was to live like Americans, to assimilate as fully as possible, only speak English, mm-hmm. Live like Americans, and try and pursue to the best of your ability the American dream. So when we look at racial discomforts in Hawaii today, and you're right that they are not, we were talking about this earlier, they are not like they are in other parts in the United States. They aren't like they are in Alabama or Peoria. They are still the result. Racial tensions here are still the result of sort of natural human sort of competitions and conflicts, and a very careful manipulation by government, by industry, and I'm going to say this really openly, by the wealthy.
Overlaid on top of all that now, after successive generations, do we actually even realize it? Do you think that people stop to think about a lot of what you've just talked about when they consider whether we have racism in Hawaii, or did they try to frame it in the ways that they did in the 50s and 60s and beyond?
I think we only stop and think about it when someone like Faye makes this outburst, or when that video that everybody saw goes viral, and suddenly we're confronted with this, you know, we are confronted at that moment with the reality, the thing that we already know, right, which is that people have strong feelings about each other, and that in the normal, you know, the way we're taught, right, is be civil, be polite, treat other people with respect. At the same time, through a variety of things, also things that we are taught to be suspicious of other people. We are taught to treat other people of different ethnicities to consider them as something other than we are. So. Altogether, what happens is we learn how to live with these things, but every now and then something happens that forces us to, that basically gets us to, you know, to focus in on those things and say, you know, where we're living here, there's racial tension here too, and who's to blame for this? Very often what happens is we wind up pointing the finger at the person who's making the outburst, but we don't look at the institutions that are helping to keep those kinds of things alive.
Which is kind of why we're having this conversation tonight. And thank you for being here. Ida, I want to bring you into this conversation too,
yeah.
Because you can't have a conversation about racism in Hawaii and not look at the criminal justice system.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you've written extensively about that. I mean, all these things, none of this exists in a vacuum. There are cross currents all over the place. We're going to get to some of it tonight. Obviously, this is by no means a be-all, end-all conversation.
Right.
But we are dealing with a disproportionate amount of people of color, particularly Hawaiian, who are in the criminal justice system.
Well, you know,
puts a whole other layer on top of everything else.
We know that the criminal justice system was implicated almost from the day the missionaries arrive. We see an effort to impose a legal system that immediately starts criminalizing a lot of what was essentially normal behavior in the Hawaiian community, starting with sexual behavior. So women are immediately marginalized and disadvantaged. But going back to some of the points John raised, I wanted to kind of mention that it's so important to know our history and to know what he was talking about in terms of how race has been used historically here in the islands and how the racial composition of the islands was viewed both locally and nationally. And I wanted to mention that in the 20s and 30s, the U.S. military made no secret of the fact that they were very interested in Hawaii as a military location, and they were very concerned that the government of the state of Hawaii did not resemble the kind of government that the U.S. military, particularly think of the U.S. Navy, was comfortable dealing with in other parts of the U.S. And so there was it wasn't even subtle. There was very overt discussion of the need to declare martial law because Hawaii was perceived to be run by non-Caucasians. And constructions, especially in the U.S. media, of Hawaii and Hawaii's population quickly made them look African-American and made them look barbaric. So there's a lot of that racist imagery at the heart of not even the history of, say, the overthrow, but coming forward in time. And so there's the role that played, of course, in cases like the Massey case, where you had this sort of racial construction of the islands deployed nationally. Then you get to the plantation system, and as John mentioned, the plantation owners, and my family were plantation managers at Eva Plantation, so I kind of speak biographically about some of this, but that system basically kept the races apart, and it paid different people, even for the same job on the plantation, you'd be paid according to your race. So a carpenter, if he was Japanese, would get paid less than a Haole carpenter, and Haole carpenters would be paid based on whether they were U.S. citizens or Scots, and Scots would be paid less, and Portuguese would be paid less, which is why if you tell a Portuguese person they're Caucasian, in Hawaii, they get very angry at you because they were discriminated against.
They were just as oppressed.
They were discriminated against. So we've got, I wanted to just mention the domains of power. So we have the U.S. military and its presence here in the islands and its very deep concern that Hawaii was out of control and needed to be in control because of its military significance. You have the plantation society that used racial divisions to, as John said, to keep the races apart. Then you get to the effect of that in terms of our social class structure. And Hawaii is not a racial utopia in the sense that everybody here is paid the same. There is no, all the ethnicities are equally advantaged in terms of education or those kinds of things. We're both racially stratified and we're class stratified. And you can pretty much go down the ethnic groups and locate the social class positions of the different ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. And Polynesians have typically been at the bottom of that scale. They're heavily criminalized. They represent 50 to 60% of the youth facility. The figures in the adult system are a little bit lower, but some of us have some questions about those data. But in any case, we know that they're similarly disproportionately represented in our adult prison system. And we also know that the product of that is it's not simply that Hawaiians commit more crime. It's also that there's bias within our systems to basically police Hawaiian communities and Polynesian communities differently than we police, say, Kahala and Hawaii Kai. So all of those are systems that are in place. And then, as John says, outcomes a situation where particularly one of the disadvantaged groups is speaking to us about how it feels. And whether it's cultural loss in some of the remarks that Representative Hanahano's talked about, whether it's, a sort of more visceral outrage that you hear in the young man's reaction to, I think, being a little bit embarrassed about what he was probably mm-hmm. doing to an animal. And he immediately throws out what we in sociology call a stereotype about Hawaiians, you know, that we beat our animals and our wives. Yeah, go ahead. And he's talking about the stereotypes. So we got stereotype, we have prejudice, we've got discrimination, we've got the historic roots of those things, we've got the people who benefited from those things. So that's all what we're bumping into, and it's the history of Hawaii.
So as we have all of this brewing, and as it has been brewing for well over 150 years, we might think, well, it's no wonder that this stuff is going to find an outlet somehow, some way, when we have some of these outbursts and when we experience whatever we may if we bump right. up against it in a way. But the question that a lot of people begin to ask is, well, how do we get better than that? Should we be getting better than that in being able to really talk to each other? We talk a lot about, civilized conversation and what that really means. Is that possible in the context that the two of you have just talked about without having a far different take on what it means to have a civilized conversation?
Before we could get to that, and this is interesting because I was asking Mita what she thought about whether there had really been any particular kind of enlightenment in terms of how we deal with race. And I was thinking not just of our situation here, but I'm thinking about, what's actually happening in the United States and America. Mm. This sort of the way in which that president has been almost made completely ineffectual. And what many of us here see really as just a continual racist attack on him personally and his attempts to move the country forward. Mm. Now, people can disagree with this, but the other part of that, and I just want to take a minute to talk about this, is you know, we're reading more and more about the growing concern among white Americans about their growing lack of a majority in terms of their ability to control the electorate.
Loss of power.
Yeah, over the next 20 years. And the attempts that are being made to redistrict and redraw district lines in order to protect their privilege as much as possible. There's no way you can see this as anything but racism. I mean, this is the protection of a particular group against another group using the institutions of the state and the laws in order to, you know, to create that thing. Here in Hawaii, and Mita made the point, that she thinks that, you know, that people really do, if they live here long enough, if they allow themselves really basically to stop seeing themselves just, and we're talking here about Americans, stop seeing themselves just as privileged people who are normal wherever they go and start to really understand that there are different communities and that people really have to find their place in that community, especially when they don't come from there. She thinks, and I do have to agree with her, that there is... there is a kind of enlightenment here that takes place, and I know people who have gone through this. My wife is one of them, and we all know people who have done this. I mean, it's basically you learn how to live with the fact that you are not you are not the normal, right? and that you have to deal with everybody else. But that doesn't change, and this is the point I want to make. That doesn't change the fact that. The way in which this society operates now and the way it's been operating and the way we have created more and more poverty and more poor people and the way we have essentially made such unequal distributions of wealth, we now have communities in which, and I live in one, I live in Palolo, and on a Saturday night, almost every Saturday night, when I'm driving home, if I'm driving home from someplace else, there's going to be a house with three or four police cars outside of it, and sirens going, and sometimes if you're driving right past, you know, you can hear the yelling. We in this place we have created communities of people who have to struggle so much with lack of opportunity, with lack of sufficient resources, with undereducation, with the threat of incarceration, with families that are shoved into small places, and the lingering, you know, threat of homelessness, that there is such despair in so many of our communities that it's not surprising that we continue to see an ongoing kind of, you know, group of people sitting at the bottom of the social ladder. How the heck do people get out of this? And we don't pay enough attention to what we do to the structures of our society and the way we manage our resources to try and bring people out of this. We basically just let them suffer.
And against all that, we tell each other a lot of stories very often about how much aloha there is here.
Right.
And how much we all get along so well, and we are a model for anyone who wants to look at us and a beacon. But it changes, you know, it changes nothing really when you look at the reality of what really happens here. The question is, can we change that reality on a lot of different levels? Maybe not all of them in exactly the way that maybe you would like, but how do we begin to approach an understanding that the racial divides that we experience in some ways could be surmountable if we changed our behavior a little bit, if we changed our understanding a little bit, and if we were able to extend ourselves a little bit to someone else's experience. Is that kind of thing possible?
Oh, let me jump in here and say, I think Hawaii actually, in the main, tells a good news story to the world. And I'll start with our outmarriage rate, because the outmarriage rate here has always been far higher than the U.S. mainland. And in recent decades...
And I want to talk about outmarriage.
Outmarriage, meaning
that you marry outside of
your racial group. And I think there's one way in which that one phenomenon, more than anything else, makes Hawaii a very unusual place, because usually those barriers are very hard to, you know, to come down. And they were here initially. There were certain ethnic groups that, you know, were kept separate and also kept themselves separate for quite a long period of time.
And families who got very angry their children
Went
off and married outside.
You think of Patsy T. Mink's own biography and her talk about when she married John Mink and how her family reacted and how his family reacted, because Japanese were not historically engaged in a lot of outmarriage. That was less true of Chinese because only Chinese men were brought over, so many of them married Hawaiian women. But in the main, overall, Hawaii for decades has had an outmarriage rate of 60 or more percentage, meaning that people are marrying across racial divides here in great numbers. And it started with Native Hawaiians, but it's now extended to many, many ethnic groups. I think Caucasians have one of the lower outmarriage rates by ethnic group. But most of the local community now is very multi-ethnic in terms of the marriages. And I think that that has a very positive social effect. You can never know, talking to someone by how they look, how their husband or wife looks, for example. And that's a huge surprise to some people.
Or by somebody's surname.
Oh, exactly. They wouldn't know if they talked to me. And I look as howly as they come. You know, I'm your typical Scot, complete with, you know, the fair coloring and you know. And then, of course, got St. Patrick's Day and all the stereotypes about white people in America. But we can go there only if we have time for a deep discussion of mayonnaise. But if we come to this issue of Hawaii as a kind of futuristic community, the U.S. mainland used to have an outmarriage rate by contrast of about 2.2%. Now, it's gone up rather dramatically in recent decades, but it's still far lower than the Hawaii outmarriage rate. So I think we have a message to give America, but the message is not that we're perfect. And I think that was always the mistake that people make, is to go from we really represent a place that the U.S. should, you know, should take a close look at. And also, you know, back to his point about race in the U.S., I think this is a very, very important historical observation about the founding of our country in particular, that we built our country around two kinds of incontrovertible silences. The first was basically the taking of land from indigenous peoples, which was normalized. And we even make movies, you know, cowboy movies about the settling of the West without...
Well, the whole issue of manifest destiny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, but then we go to slavery and the institution of slavery. And that has haunted and continues to haunt, I would agree, the U.S. in ways that are profound. And again, you look at the criminal justice system and how that system has functioned in what Michelle Alexander calls as the new Jim Crow, as a new way to enforce racial privilege. So, and then we have the situation of our president, who I would have to agree, the visceral anger that it's his very existence seems to conjure up on the part of certain working class whites in particular. Deeply troubling, and a terrible comment on us as a society,
and a lack of real understanding about the fact that he's biracial. Most people say
yeah.
A black president.
Oh,
there are a lot of people who are very angry that there wasn't a discussion
of his mother, who's extraordinary, and of course, you know, I'd love to go into that, but I think that the heart of what we're talking about here is can we acknowledge the racist past in Hawaii, and can we look at it? I think one of the important responsibilities of Caucasians who come here is, as John said, well, first to understand that you're a minority in this community. And I think some people, you know, coming from places like Iowa, where it's, you know, I go a lot to Iowa, so I know about Iowa. And Iowans are actually very enlightened when it comes to race, but still, you walk around Des Moines, and you're going to see a lot of white people. And so that was America, kind of Mayberry RFD America. Well, that was never Hawaii. And so I think the first thing that Caucasians have to get when they come here is what the history of this place is and what your place in that history is. And I think some people resent that. They say, well, this is America. I shouldn't have to do that.
And sometimes that's what turns up in some of the discussions
yeah.
that we've had in past.
Yeah.
Now, if you've been waiting to get into this conversation, the phone lines are open at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We want to hear what you have to say and what your experiences tell you. And if, in fact, you stop to think of any of the historical context when you hear about issues that pop up from time to time, or what we see happen with outbursts as we've seen in the last year and a half or so, does any of this really enter your consciousness as you look at racism in Hawaii? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. All right, we've taken some time to lay some groundwork here, but now let's jump up to where we are right now. There was a lot of conversation about what we should and shouldn't expect from elected officials and how maybe there's a different standard for that when you put yourself into that position as opposed to being a private person. What does it mean to have the public persona and, you know, the private person behind it? What's the nexus of those things when you are an elected official? How much do you get to release? And if Fei Hanohano simply made that a transparent line?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I don't necessarily think that a public official or public elected official has a greater responsibility to behave civilly in public and to treat other people with respect. I mean, I honestly believe that we all bear the same responsibility of doing that. Now, here's what I think. I mean, when you look at Hanohano's remarks on both occasions that, you know, sort of come to the press, the first one in her comment that she was angry that there was no Kanaka Maoli painting in her office, and she resented the fact that all the paintings were done by, I'm sorry, Japs and Pakes and other people.
It's nothing that we haven't talked about before.
So she says these things, and you realize that this is a boorish, disrespectful, uncivil thing to say, and you wonder, you know, who taught her? You know, who are her parents? You know, what did her parents teach her about, you know, watching your speech, effectively communicating things? Because she certainly could have communicated the same thing without offending anyone.
And maybe making her point even better.
Absolutely. So you wonder, okay, so what does this mean? And let's take, for people who think that this is a racist remark, I would simply say, racism for me is when you use racial prejudice and you are able, either as a public official or using the law or using institutions to oppress another people. That's racism. What she did was uncivil and rude, and she should have been taken to task for that. But did she injure the Japanese and Chinese artistic population in Hawaii? Did they have to go underground? did they suddenly, you know, start losing all of their customers because of what she said? We know how racism has been used against the people in places like Germany, or the thousands of Japanese who were rounded up at the start of World War II, who lost everything and were confined to, that's racism and that's harm. So here's what I have to say about this. Again, what she said was ugly, and people should hold her accountable for that. But I also wish that public officials would also listen to the people who come and give testimony to them. The second one is the one that also disturbs me. She said, you know, she basically completely dismissed this young man who came and gave testimony. Did she injure him? No, because he went and contacted a reporter. He reported this. He made her look like a fool. But what she did was she just demonstrated something that more and more legislators, it seemed to me, continue to do. They don't listen to us when we give testimony. They can be really polite. They can be really, really civil. But if you're opposing a construction project, if you're trying to protect a community, if you're trying to speak to them about humanizing the prison system, mm-hmm. do they listen to you?
But in this case, this was a bill that she had introduced, which he was also testifying in support of, which would sort of doesn't sync with the idea that he was the recipient of such vitriol.
That's probably not the best way to actually for me to actually put this is to focus on that particular thing. I was just trying to make the point that we expect people to be civil with each other, but one of the things I think we've been losing ground on is having legislators actually pay attention to testimony when it's coming in.
That's a whole other show, and I promise we're going to have that one too. But we've got lots of callers on the line. We're going to stop talking for a bit and let you do the talking. Going now to John calling us from the McCully area. Aloha, John. Thanks for your patience.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm really glad you guys are having this conversation to begin with. I'm very aware of your dialogue that you're having. And
when you say you're very aware of it from a personal experience,
from both personal, academic, philosophical, economical, your problem you're discussing, which is my problem too, it's been my problem all my life. This problem we're discussing started thousands of years before we were all born. This is way beyond a racist problem. The origin of this problem started in India thousands of years ago with the Aryans. When the Aryans came to India, the exact same you're describing right now happened there.
So you're saying that this is just a recapitulation of a cycle that's been going on for thousands of years. That's your point.
Yes, and I'm also saying it also has to do with the fact that back then, the universities were one way. I'm going to be real honest with you guys. I've done a lot of research in this. Right now, I'm currently reading a book called Beyond Culture by Edward T. Hall. I want you to know something, that this whole problem in the modern world is directly related to the universities, the politics, and the churches.
Which seems to be very much the point that we started with you, John, saying that they're organized institutions that have been manipulating racism. Mm-hmm. And, his point is, you need to take it back even further because it's happened in other cultures,
sure.
in other
Absolutely.
Places, and that this is not something that's unique to Hawaii. Thanks, John, very much for the call. We're going to go off now to Fred calling us from Pahoa. Aloha, Fred. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. That was a great call, but I think that part of the way that institutions encourage racism is by encouraging non-Caucasians to be racist as well. And so far, I've only heard examples of racist Caucasians coming out of one of the panelists. But I think that it's true that all races are racist to some degree, or there are racist members of all races. And I think that using the word haole, which is a contraction of a'ole, which means no, and ha, which means spirit, is a really racist thing to do.
All right, let's take that one on a little bit. Fred, thanks very much for the call. When we first began the hour, I didn't hear you address only Caucasians in saying they're the ones who are racist, but they were, in your mind and in the minds of a lot of people, ones who were manipulating institutions to be able to make sure that we had racism, that you had races at odds with each other simply to control them. But to Fred's point that, look, there's racism in all groups and how we deal with it and that sense of other, you also addressed that point.
I did, and I basically said that I don't think that what Faye Hanohano did and what she said was racist. I said that what she said was rude. I said that what she said was uncivil. For those of us who have been, thinking and working about with this notion of racism, what we see with that particular thing is when you combine racial prejudice with a very pronounced institutional power behind you, with law, with economics, with a powerful kind of with literature.
With academia.
With academia, absolutely. Yeah. And you say these things over and over and over again. You create a situation in which you justify the oppression of a group of people. That's racism. And I'm not saying that Americans are the only ones who've ever done this, because that's clearly not true. And I'm not saying that we're not capable of racism. I'm not saying that Hawaiians couldn't, if it was our country, for instance, again, that we couldn't behave in that kind of fashion to somebody else that we outnumbered or that we overwhelmed. But that's not the case here. And we're not even talking about a group of people railing against white people, which, by the way, I find white people actually a more offensive term. Howley is a very natural term for us.
Thanks.
Because it actually refers to basically originally these foreigners.
Yeah, being born someplace else.
Born someplace else.
Foreign people.
So, you know, this is the thing. I don't want us to just disagree over the terminology. But I really, really want to be very clear that if you're going to equate the mouthings of, of a woman who's clearly stressed out and doesn't control her tongue, with a very careful kind of, manipulation of people's destinies, through, again, through laws and economics.
Can I cut to the chase here? Your point is that we really aren't talking about racism.
Right.
When we talk about what Faye Hanohano did,
we're talking about maybe prejudice.
The word may be prejudiced, and she may be rude, and she may have done a lot of things in that way. But you're saying that we need to look at what does racism really, really mean, and what kind of harm are we talking about at a macro level?
Right. Can I
really
just
briefly
pop in?
Because okay. we've got a lot of callers, and I got to get to these folks.
Oh, I just want to remind people that you've got prejudice and you have discrimination, and you also have stereotypes. We could even plop that in there. But a stereotype is simply an exaggerated idea or belief. It could be a positive one about an ethnic group, like all Chinese are rich or, very good at math. And you could argue these are stereotypes, but they're obviously positive in a capitalist society to say someone's rich. Prejudice is simply an attitude about a group, and it's usually now a negative attitude. But that's not illegal, even in the United States, to have attitudes about things and to have feelings about people. That's not illegal. What is illegal is to take that action based on prejudicial attitudes and to do something that specifically disadvantages somebody because of their race.
And that's what John is talking about.
That's what prejudice is. And so John is trying to make a distinction between, say, a use of a racial epithet, which you could argue is a negative stereotype, and Faye would argue is simply a local word that many people use, but that is pejorative, versus systematic and also institutional racism, and that's discrimination. And that's where groups are systematically advantaged or disadvantaged, either explicitly in the law or explicitly in contracts.
Okay.
That's discrimination. That's illegal in the U.S.
And maybe some of these things we need to remind ourselves of as we have conversations.
That's Soch 101, but
A lot of people will confuse those terms
them
interchangeably.
Right. They'll conflate prejudice and discrimination.
Now we're going to move on to a lot of you have been waiting to get in on this conversation. Going now to David calling us from Makiki. Aloha, David.
Aloha. Thank you for this conversation. It's very, very helpful.
David, we have a horrible connection to you. So I'm going to ask you to be brief on it just because this connection is really awful. Otherwise, you can call back and we can try to put you on in a minute.
Sure, yeah, no problem. I just wanted to point out, and the guests have done that, that, we have to be careful talking about racism because, ultimately, and this is not oversimplifying it, but we are one race, and many times these discriminations And these prejudices come and are perpetuated in our capitalist system because of economic gains that one group can gain from another. So
all right.
The only way out of it is education and, you know, social justice.
And David, I wish we could go on. We have this horrible squeak that's coming in, so you're welcome to call us back. Thanks very much
for
the call.
Good point, David.
And a very good point.
Yep.
And we're going to go now off to Dan. And Dan's calling us from where, David? From Waianae. Thank you for your call. Aloha, Dan.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make this short. I'm listening to your discussion, and is there a model in which we can look at other nations or other countries that have sort of overcome these barriers that we're talking about and have brought the people of any culture up to parity within a capitalist system? And so,
all right, good question okay. for both of you. Is there really a model out there that we can look to, or do we say, hey, this is just part of the human condition? I mean, you guys aren't jumping here saying, so-and-so did it well.
The first model I would look at would be the Kingdom of Hawaii, and it's not like it actually created parity. Certainly not economically. Chinese were basically labor. They were paid as cheaply as they could possibly be paid. Kanaka were essentially disappearing and dying, but some of them were employed by the government. Some of them were working on plantations. It turns out that many of the wealthiest people in the society were hauli, but on the other hand, the government was really firmly in the hands of Hawaiians, and the government was opened. You know, from 1852 until 1887, your ethnicity and not, you know, your ethnicity did not affect whether or not you could become a subject and vote and participate in government.
You embraced equally.
Yeah. In fact, there were 400 Chinese citizens by the 1880s. The only people who were really oppressed in all of this were women, by the way.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
That's a whole other conversation.
But that's another conversation.
Right, right.
But the truth of the matter is if you wanted to see a country that actually took seriously this notion that you know, people were, you know, equally able to govern and participate, it would be the Hawaiian Kingdom.
All right, we're going to leave it there for the moment and move on to Mickey calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Mickey. Welcome to Town Square.
Okay, aloha. What I wanted to say was that it's not whether or not we discriminate, because everyone discriminates. It's how we discriminate. When people are racist, it's based upon their attitudes of superiority. They have this very fragile sense of superiority. Mm-hmm. So they feel that, you know, in hate, they have to do actions and behaviors that are going to make them feel superior. And it, so what happens, they're separated more by their differences and their similarities. And one of the things that we do to help assuage the situation is we do a food curriculum where our students learn, you know, by sharing food, language and culture of other countries, to realize that, you know, in the end, we all like the same things, and we're more similar than we are different. The difference adds spice to it, not in a way to make us, to be, you know, to be hateful, but in a way that makes, you know, where it can be enjoyed by all, and it creates a certain, you know, cosmopolitan feeling in the classroom.
And you got better restaurants here in the islands than many places elsewhere.
That's a nice perk. Go ahead.
Let me make one other point. Back to several callers ago, we had a point made about the construction of race. So let's make it really clear to everybody that there is no biological racial difference. What we have are actually cultures that have been marked, usually socially. But if you talk about us biologically as a species, we're one species.
Mm-hmm. Which goes back to, I think, what David's
point was. So there's no biological basis, as one of our callers mentioned. And I think it's really important to keep that in mind, because there's always been this effort to find biological differences between the races. And it always came up.
Or make them up.
And invent things. And that didn't mean that that cultures weren't victimized biologically, in that we had these sterilization efforts, we had efforts to steal right. people's children. And thinking about the Kamehameha schools, Ian's mother went to Kamehameha in the 20s and 30s, and she was forbidden to speak Hawaiian. They were forbidden to do the hula. They all did it in secret right. if they did it at all. So it's hard for people to wrap their minds around how systematically the culture was being deconstructed by even entities that were supposed to be educating Native Hawaiians. And there was one other earlier point I did want to agree with, and that's the role of colonialism in racism, because the mention was made of India. Mm-hmm. And Hawaii was also a victim of colonialism. So that's another theme in the discussion that we want to at least remember and keep in our minds. So just a couple of those points. But on the food thing, my students, when we were doing a study of why people felt okay about marrying across ethnic groups, and one of the students said very blithely, she said, well, you have better food when you marry a different ethnicity, because, you know, you get your food plus their food.
And, well, I mean, these are some of the nice things about it, that it's not all this horrible, terrible picture, but we've got a lot of things that right. simmer and brew beneath the subtext of all of
but there,
this.
Is there and, a model globally? I think people have looked to places like Canada, but then once we dig a little more deeply, yeah. we discover the treatment of First Nations people in Canada.
Well, there you go.
And, you know, we look at places like Great Britain, and we thought that was all copacetic, and now look at the troubles in urban unrest, particularly again.
And the Scots might leave.
Ah, yes, and the Scots want out.
All right, you
too.
I'm reining you back in.
All right.
We're going to go back to the phone lines now and talk to Sharon, calling us from Kapaa. Aloha, Sharon. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. I'm calling from Kapaa on Kauai. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can.
Oh, yeah.
It's
Thank
just
you.
Fine.
This is an interesting conversation and refreshing. I am here for 3 years, going on four now. I moved here because of the spirit that I feel in this particular island. I was told by I was music director of the church for many years, and the minister had been a minister on Kauai, on Oahu, and he told me that there was such diversity in Hawaii, and he missed that because this was in Atlanta. I was living in Atlanta when I met him and worked with him. But he talked about the diversity, but in speaking about the diversity, he didn't really share with me the underground, the underlying negative energy that exists. Everyone's going around being polite, not really telling the truth. And so when you get outbursts, as you've been discussing, everybody acts as if they're so surprised. But I think that one thing we want to acknowledge is that there seems to be something in the human genome or something that people that are of darker skin. I am a woman of color. My great-great-grandfather was a slave owner. My great-great-grandmother was a slave. Mm. My great-grandmother remembered seeing her father beat her mother at the slave post. So, you know, in thinking about this, I think about the pain of it all. The pain comes to me, and I think that so many people, it's so easy for them to just say, well, that happened back then, and that doesn't affect us. Mm-hmm. It does. I believe it's in the DNA. People whose families were slaves, I don't care whether it was in America or if it was bad treatment here in Hawaii or if it was the untouchables in India. There is that resentment, that pain, and that fear is going to be is somehow passed down, if I'm not mistaken, through the DNA without it even being recognized that that's what's going on.
And all right, I'm going to stop you right
with the fact that the criminal justice system is the new slavery. It's the new Jim Crow.
That's what we sort of started talking the conversation in the first part of the hour. Sharon, I'm going to stop you right there because I want to get a little bit of what we've been talking about sort of funneled back into how we began the conversation with what we are experiencing right now. I mean, having a good basis for understanding all of this, carrying this forward in our day-to-day lives, and maybe being willing to really look in the mirror and say, you know, why am I thinking that? Or exactly. something that just came out of exactly. my mouth. Why and how? Because your experience now here, Sharon, is very different than what it would be, I would imagine, in Atlanta. And yet we're still talking about some of the same issues, just a different shade or a different permutation of it. Thanks so much for the call.
I'm thinking about the way in which, you know, people who live here and people who love living here, especially people who love living here, have managed to sort of navigate all kinds of things, you know, ethnic difference, difficulty of living, you know, having a hard time basically affording a mortgage, all of those kinds of things, high cost of living, high cost of travel, whatever, all of those things. And, you know, we all navigate those things sort of together. And I think that that's the really, really, really great part about this society. I think the part about the society that I'm not so proud of is the way we don't pay close enough attention to the things that are being done to us, and the way in which business and globalization and all of those things we have just let them run over us, and to the point really where our future as a community, the future of our children living here, has become so compromised by these economic changes, and our unwillingness sometimes to look at that. I mean, you say look in the mirror, and I say I think we do a pretty good job of looking in the mirror and sort of evaluating, you know, why we love it here and how you need to get along with other people. I think we ought to take a really much closer look at people in government, at the investors, at the kind of economic society that they're shaping here. And I think we need to do this because there is so much promise here.
Yeah.
Because this is such a really amazing place and community of people.
Can we talk to some more of those people now?
Yeah.
All right. I want to get some more of the callers in. Going to Christine, calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Christine. I'm going to ask you to be brief because we're coming
Aloha.
Up to the top
I
of
will.
The hour. Hi there.
I will. And I have a positive spin. I moved here 4 years ago. My son had moved here from Seattle, both of us, 8 years ago. And I tell you what. I don't think I could be a mainlander again. I have been met with nothing but gracious people of all ethnicities. Maybe I've just been fortunate. And it's very inclusive, and I love that. Like the previous caller from Atlanta, I do miss the black racial influence. But we are all one, and I have just been met with such gracious.
Well, Christine, I'm
people,
glad. I'm,
you know,
I'm
from,
glad
from
that you're
little,
having a good experience.
From the little shell station to wherever, and people have got to learn to be what I had to learn my first couple of years was that this is a community made up of a very humble bunch of cultures, Japanese. All the Asian and so forth. And I do believe required reading for everybody that really wants to live here is Hawaii, which was written by the same guy that wrote Molokai. And it really shows what the people, the plantation people, and everybody else had to go through to make a dent here.
Christine, I'm going to stop you right there for the moment because I'm glad that you're here and that you're having a good experience and that so far so good for you. But as you know, you've brought up some of the other issues that I want to leverage into some of the conversation here with some of the folks who are calling us still and also still here at the table. You know, when someone comes here and you're happy to be here, the feeling of being in Hawaii, all of that, and the way you start to look out at the world begins to change, though, over time as you're here and you have to experience some of the things that may take some of the rosiness away from maybe your first year or two. Of people who will transplant here for a little while and then just say, you know, I can't stay here. I mean, it feels nice, but I can't make a living. Going back to all the economic issues that you talked about before, the cost of the mortgage, the cost of the schooling, all of those things, none of those things, you know, feed in, by themselves. They're all there, the confluence of all of them that make it someone's experience. The point being that sometimes someone is not here long enough or maybe in situations where they would potentially feel some of the issues that you've brought up tonight. And that shouldn't be taken as being a universal experience either.
Right.
Well, you first of all, again, have to remember that living here is different from vacationing here. And, you know, many people's experience initially of Hawaii is that it's so geographically distinct and the weather is so unique and the flora and fauna are so unique. But they're in a kind of tourist bubble. And so there's, you know, once you move into the real Hawaii, that is this place, it's a different world. And you, especially as a Caucasian, discover that people have a name for you, and as has come up in this call, some people might resent hearing a name for you that wasn't one you picked. You may be from a place where you got to be it, and everybody else was not it, and now suddenly you realize, well, who is it here? And so I think there is a sense of when you come here having to recognize coming out of that sort of tourist bubble of whatever they were in, to a kind of place that's real, where people have real jobs. Then I want to pick up on John's point about the inequality that we've normalized here in the islands. I go every year to Maui and at Wailea, and I'm struck when I walk along the beach in Wailea at these palatial estates that are all completely vacant. And we've normalized an inequality that's global and stunning. Where whole swaths of beach that used to be vacant and beautiful places for all of us to enjoy are now being carved up by human beings who don't even live here.
So let me ask both of you this thing. So because we're coming down to the last part of the hour, and I'm sorry that we're not going to be able to get to the rest of the callers, but you know, having both of you here, this is really sounding as if this is turning into a have-not
absolutely
conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, this, I think, not just Representative Hanohano's outbursts, but I'm also thinking of that video that all of us saw of that young man sort of responding and really acting out in a very, very abusive kind of language to the people that were sitting in that park.
Yeah.
This, you know, the frustration of this sort of not just ongoing inequality, but this growing inequality, the greater and greater struggles by people, you know, basically just to get by here. This is actually the thing. You wonder why we don't pay more critical attention to this every single day. Instead, that's the kind of thing that goes viral, right? Is somebody yelling.
Okay, so what does that really say about us, though?
Let's take pictures of these giant mansions that are literally used for Bed Bath and Beyond commercials.
I'm saying, if we are talking about this, that it only takes one of these things to go viral, or a conversation about what Faye Hanohano did, said, whatever, or anybody else, fill in the blank, and we don't look at it on a daily basis, as John
well,
is
you
saying.
Need to
what
look
is
at
it
the,
saying that
you
about
You have
us?
To look at the sources of the resentment. I think that's what we're trying to say, that the resentment exists and exists in certain ethnic groups shouldn't surprise anybody looking at
right.
the demography that we've been discussing. That if you have 60% of the kids at our youth facility Hawaiian, part Hawaiian, when they're 13 to 15% of the youth population, that's a deeply troubling statistic. But it's not problematic. As you say, John, people sail right by that place in Kailua and don't think for a minute about what it represents in the lives of the Native Hawaiian community. That's the kind of resentment that's burbling up to the surface here. Right,
guys, right. We are coming up to the end of the program. We've got about 50 seconds before we have to say goodbye. So let me thank you both for being here. Mina Chesney-Lynn, thank you so much for being here. John Osorio, we'll do it again and with you sometime soon. Thanks for joining us tonight for Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you tomorrow morning on The Conversation. Meanwhile, have yourselves a good evening. Aloha.